It's Pledge Week on the Public Radio Hour tonight, and we hope to help encourage you to support storytelling in the Tennessee Valley. We'll spend the next hour hearing from some of the best storytelling programs on our main signal. Stay tuned as we push past the point of no return with Snap Judgment.
I knew when I saw you that you were going to end up in this journey. And the things that I taught you kept you alive. He was right.
We'll also ask ourselves, how far would I go to get an education, with a powerful story from the TED Radio Hour.
So for the next 5 years, I dressed as a boy to escort my older sister, who was no longer allowed to be outside alone, to a secret school. It was the only way we both could be educated.
And we'll learn how to be a hero with Radiolab and hear from one of the best storytellers in music, Jason Isbell, on the World Cafe. The Public Radio Hour is coming up next, right after this news update.
I'm Daniela Perelon, and I'm the Marketing and PR Manager for Arts Huntsville. Arts Huntsville is a nonprofit arts organization, and we need all the help we can get to get the word out about the events that we have that really make Huntsville a lively and energized place to live. Groups like Arts Huntsville and other arts organizations are putting on events that make people want to live here and stay here and raise their kids here. They make it an exciting community, and WLRH helps us get the word out about all of those exciting arts and culture events in our community. When you support WLRH, you are, in effect, supporting the arts and cultural community at large. You are supporting your neighbors, the people who are hosting events and putting on concerts and, you know, doing all sorts of things that make this community great. I'm Daniela, and I support WLRH. I hope you will, too.
Hey, this is David Green here, and I want to tell you that there is a big difference between quality reporting and news that just skims the surface. Let's compare it to cleaning. Running a damp paper towel over a countertop, it doesn't do the job, right? And neither does skimming social media for the headlines. You really want to be informed, and that's why you turn to us. We go deep. We get behind the furniture and into the corners, and we find the angles no one else is covering. For example,
NPR's David Folkenflik broke that story.
Even prior to what we reported yesterday,
Rosa Cruz and her husband haven't had electricity.
Noguchi reports as part of our week-long look at the rise of the freelance workforce.
The NPR Marist poll found
a good vacuum always cleans better than one of those wet takeout napkins, right? The difference is worth the investment. So invest in us. Here's how to do it.
Thanks for tuning in the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville Public Radio. I'm Brett Tannehill. This is our spring fun drive, and we're encouraging you to support your favorite programs. They need you, and we need you, to make sure our community service mission stays alive and well. An investment in this station is an investment in our community, because we provide programs that educate, inform, and entertain, and we also turn your dollars into a powerful voice for local nonprofits through our public service announcement program. There are lots of reasons to support this station, and we hope over the next hour we can convince just a few of you to come on board for the first time. We're trying to reach a goal of $120,000 by the end of this week, and we won't get there unless we have your help. So please go to WLRH.org and do what you can to support your favorite programs. Speaking of favorite programs, Radiolab has long been a public radio mainstay on this channel, and we know that for many of you, it's one of your favorites.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radio
from
WNYC.
Yep. Hey, this is Radio Lab. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Okay, so you ready for this, Robert?
I am ready.
All right, so a while back, we did this story that, for us at least, really stuck in our heads. It was a story that was asking this really deep question, and the answer that we got to...
The answer didn't quite click.
Right.
I remember it that way.
Yeah. And so just to sort of set the table, the question was, why do people do good in the world? So we asked that question, looked at it from the perspective of genetics, computer science, all kinds of things. We ended up profiling these three extraordinarily, heroically good people.
Yes, they were heroes. They did remarkable things, each one.
And we told their stories with that question in mind. Why do certain people do good in the world and others don't?
Yeah.
And so we're going to revisit that question today in the story that we told. Because I think we have something better and smarter to say about it, finally.
Something very peculiar to say about it, as it turns out.
Yeah, so we're going to play you the original first, and then we're going to come back and hopefully shed some new light on it.
Yeah. And by the way, this is a fundraising version of Radiolab, so if you are in the mood, or we can get you in the mood, please consider contributing to your local public radio station, and we'll tell you how to do that at the break.
So,
here we go.
Again, this story just began with a simple question. That question led us...
Walter Rutkowski.
To a guy named Walter Rutkowski.
And I'm the executive director and secretary of the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission.
Cool. Well, thanks for doing this.
Okay.
Can you just give us a little background on the Hero Fund? What is the Carnegie Hero Fund?
The Carnegie Hero Fund is a private operating foundation, and what we do is recognize civilian heroism throughout the United States and Canada by giving an award called the Carnegie Medal, and accompanying the Carnegie Medal is a financial grant.
How much?
Currently, the amount is $5,000.
Wow. And how do you guys choose your heroes?
We judge the heroic acts against a list of requirements.
So then you have to have some kind of definition of hero, which includes some and excludes others.
Yes.
Perfect.
A basic definition, which is a civilian.
One.
Meaning no military, who voluntarily.
Two.
Leaves a point of safety.
Three.
To risk his own life or her own life.
Four.
To an extraordinary degree.
Five.
To save or to attempt to save the life of another human.
Six. And how about seven? Why? Like, what is it that happens in a person's mind at that pivotal moment when they decide to voluntarily
leave a point of safety
and risk their life to an extraordinary degree
to save the life of another human?
That's what we wanted to know. So the first one we have on our list is Laura Schrake.
Okay.
I am Laura Schrake. I'm from Mattoon, Illinois, and I currently live in Dubai, United Arab Emirates.
Oh, wow.
Laura spoke with our producer, Tim Howard.
Okay, so we're going back a little bit here.
Back in the mid-90s.
1995.
I was a 21-year-old college student.
And I was driving through the country, and I saw a woman getting mauled by a bull in a pasture.
So she stopped to see what was going on.
Jumped out and started yelling at her to see what I could do. The woman was on the ground and the bull was...
950-pound Jersey bull.
Tossing her in the air and back on the ground.
Wow.
She was clearly struggling.
And where were you?
I was right on the other side of the fence, but the fence was electric.
So here's the moment that we find fascinating. At this point, Laura can either go forward through thousands of volts of electricity toward an angry bull that will likely maul her too, or she can stay safe.
I went ahead and just climbed through the fence. And I don't remember ever feeling the electricity.
She says by the time she got through,
crazily enough,
a neighbor had shown up and threw her a piece of pipe.
Maybe about 2 feet long.
So she approached the woman,
who was still conscious. The whole time she's yelling at me, hit the bull in the face as hard as you can and don't stop.
So Miss Shrake went up to the bull and beat it repeatedly with this 2 foot length of tubing.
I think it distracted the bull enough where she was able to get out from under him. And as soon as we were outside the fence, looking back into the pasture, the bull was literally right there at the fence.
Kicked the ground a few times and snorted.
He was not happy.
When you were there at that fence,
mm-hmm.
What was going through your mind? Was there a calculation there?
No, I can't really say that. I mean...
You didn't weigh your options or anything like that?
I did not, no. It was just, here's the problem, here's what I need to do, and something needed to happen.
Huh.
If nobody came to this woman's rescue, she would die.
This is the usual explanation, says Walter. No explanation.
I couldn't stand there and not do anything. I was compelled to act.
I didn't really take the time to think about what else could happen.
Now, I can't say I ever really thought about my own life at that time.
Okay, we just jumped ahead because we thought we'd try again. That's the voice of the next Carnegie hero that Walter told us about.
Yeah, William David Pennell.
Name's William Pennell.
Our producer, Lynn Levy, tracked him down.
Bill, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Was it 1999?
Yes, it was early in the morning. It was like
3:19 a.m. in a small town near Pittsburgh.
We was in bed sleeping and... My wife heard a loud crash. I actually didn't hear it, but the dog, my one dog was carrying on. So right away, I run down there.
Mr. Pennell went outside his house. There was a very bad automobile accident. A car crashed head-on into a utility pole.
Flames was like rippling up the windshield out from under the hood.
So here we are. Bill's standing in front of this ball of fire. There are three teenagers inside that car, though he doesn't know it. He can either A, do nothing, or B, go in
through the driver's door.
And this big fella slumped out the door, so I reached in and grabbed a hold of him.
Around the chest, pulled him from the driver's seat out to the ground.
Meantime, the car was just like blazing. And my neighbor was there. She was hollering, there's more of them in there. So I run back to the vehicle.
Found that the front seat passenger was trapped in the wreckage.
I finally got him loose and pulled him out.
Apparently, Mr. Pennell was aware that a third person was in the car, a third young man. Mr. Pennell entered the car a third time. By then,
there was tires blowing out.
Flames had grown to about 3 feet above the car's roof.
The interior, like the headliner of the car and stuff, was dripping like plastic down on my back. I mean, I'm in there screaming, you know, somebody give me a hand in here. But nobody would help. And I reached in and grabbed a hold of the kid that was in the back by the scruff of the neck and pulled him out.
All right, so when you were coming out of your house and you're looking at that car, what was going through your head?
Just trying to help. I mean, I did what any normal person would do. I mean, you know, I just kept saying, this is somebody's kid, you know what I mean?
Did you ever talk to your neighbors and ask them why they didn't come in there?
You know what? It's funny you brought that up because, no, I've never brought it up. Never brought it up.
How come?
I don't know. I guess maybe I probably wouldn't like their answer. I don't know.
What do you think is the difference between you and those other people who just sort of stood by?
I couldn't answer that.
Somebody must be able to tell us something about what they were thinking at that moment that allowed them, that gave them the courage to do what they did.
I can't give you a definite answer as to what propels people to do this, no.
But we took one more shot with Walter, and after we take a quick break, we're going to hear one more hero story from him. That's when we come back.
But before we leave, if you want to, you know, do something a wee bit heroic on your own, please consider giving to your local public radio station. And should you be mystified about how to do the heroic deed, here's a simple, handy-dandy way to do it.
It's not as hard as you might think, and it only takes a few minutes to be a hero and support your local public radio station. This is the Public Radio Hour, and we're encouraging you to support our spring fund drive right now with a pledge at WLRH.org. If you're a fan of Radiolab, be sure to mention it in the comments, because we're building our program schedule around the programs that you enjoy. This next clip comes from a show that made it onto our main signal because people asked for it. The TED Radio Hour is now one of our most popular programs and really supports the idea of storytelling that we like to foster in our community. Hopefully you'll listen and be inspired to give at WLRH.org.
Hi, I'm Leela Paul, and I'm from Connecticut. I listen to Stay Informed. I love hearing about community events. My daughters almost always hear about something that they would like to do. There's so much happening in this area. If I didn't have something to touch base with, I don't think I would have a good handle on everything this area has to offer. People should support WLRH because WLRH gives back to the community. I'm Leela, and I support WLRH, and I hope you will too.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And today on the show, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to share some of our favorite segments from the past few years. And these are stories and ideas that really inspired us. And hopefully you'll be inspired to help public radio so that we can keep bringing you these incredible stories, like this one from Shabana Basij Rasik.
You know, I grew up thinking, believing that it was normal for a girl to risk her life in order to get an education.
Shabana grew up in Kabul, Afghanistan, in a home with five other siblings.
Two older sisters, one older brother, and I have a younger sister and a younger brother.
Shabana's parents had big dreams for all of their kids, and education was a top priority. So every day, her older siblings would head to school, while Shabana, still too young to start school, would study at home with her mom.
When I look back at my early education, it's my mother who helped me and all of my siblings learn how to read and write.
But then one day, in 1996, the Taliban took control of Kabul and imposed strict new rules that completely changed the city, especially for women.
When the Taliban came to power, they required women to wear a burqa, so essentially covering themselves head to toe, often in a blue-colored veil. And they were not allowed to walk outside alone. They had to be escorted by a male family member. Girls would be prohibited from attending school. Women would not be allowed to go to work.
So Shabana's two older sisters had to drop out of school.
They had no option, especially my older sister had no option. She had just graduated high school. The only option she had was to go abroad. My second oldest sister, whose education was cut off in seventh grade, her options were limited too.
Basically, her only option was to go to a secret school. But to do that, she would need Shabana's help.
And that's when I remember me dressing up as a boy became a serious conversation.
Shabana picks up that story from the TED stage.
So for the next 5 years, I dressed as a boy to escort my older sister, who was no longer allowed to be outside alone, to a secret school. It was the only way we both could be educated. Each day, we took a different route so that no one would suspect where we were going. We would cover our books in grocery bags so it would seem we were just out shopping. The school was in a house, more than 100 of us packed in one small living room. It was cozy in winter, but extremely hot in summer. We all knew we were risking our lives, the teacher, the students, and our parents. From time to time, a school would suddenly be canceled for a week because Taliban were suspicious. We always wondered what they knew about us.
I mean, were you scared every day? Were you just terrified?
I think, you know, some days we weren't scared. I think sometimes, human nature is pretty interesting. You know, sometimes when you do something on a daily basis, it becomes your new normal. And then occasionally we had these real reminders of how incredibly risky it was to be doing what we were doing. You know, sometimes those reminders came in different ways. It was either hearing stories about a secret school being discovered by the Taliban and the teacher being beheaded in front of the students, the students being punished or their families being punished. Some days it was feeling like we were being followed. And I think those were the most scariest experiences. We would either randomly walk into somebody's house whose door was open and stay there for several minutes and then get out and go back to our home and not even go to the secret school as we were instructed, because we didn't want to potentially lead anyone to the secret school. Or some days just walk into the market and pretend like we were out shopping and then come home and beg our parents to stop sending us to the secret school. We would ask them, you know, like, why can't we be like every other girl in our neighborhood or in our relatives who don't take this risk? What is the point? Why do we have to go to the secret school? It's not like we're going to graduate high school and go to college, get a job and work. Why are we risking all of our lives? Why can't we just sit at home? I feel now, looking back at all of that, I feel so guilty because I can't imagine being my mother. You know, I can't imagine what went through her head every single day. You know, she would say goodbye to us And she had no idea if we would return home alive. She had no idea what time to expect us to come home. But they were so patient in explaining to us why it was important that we risked our lives to get an education.
My father, he would say, "Listen, my daughter, you can lose everything you own in your life. Your money can be stolen. You can be forced to leave your home during a war. But the one thing that will always remain with you is what is here. And if we have to sell our blood to pay your school fees, we will. So do you still not want to continue?" I remember waking up one morning to the sound of joy in my house. My father was listening to BBC News on his small gray radio. There was a big smile on his face, which was unusual then because the news mostly depressed him. "The Taliban are gone," my father shouted. "You can go to a real school now," he said.
It's amazing because you were literally going undercover for 5 years just to get an education, something that the vast majority of us take for granted.
Yeah, I thought this is how it was done everywhere, that this is what girls had to do. And then 9/11 happened. Then the Taliban regime was toppled. Then in 2002, as an 11-year-old girl, soon to be 12 years old, I found myself in a public school for the very first time in my life. There were thousands and thousands of girls, most wearing burqa, some young like me, not wearing a burqa, around the school. And this was the day we were getting our results after several tests that we had taken. The Taliban regime obviously had burnt all the records of, girls. And so the government announced that girls could come to school to take an entrance exam into whatever grade they felt comfortable being placed into. So I took the entrance exam for sixth grade going into seventh grade. And the day that our results were being announced, my teacher called up my name. And when she looked at me, she had this shock on her face and she said, "Oh no." And I faced the group of students standing there who were meant to be in my class. And I was shocked as well. Most of these girls were 6 years older than I was. And that was the very first time I realized how incredibly lucky I was to have the parents I have. That was the very first time I had great appreciation for what my parents tried to tell us all along during the Taliban regime, that sending us to a secret school, that allowing us to get an education despite the risk was going to be the biggest investment in our life, and that, yes, we probably didn't realize it at that time, but we would at some point. And I was standing there. All I wanted to do was to hug my parents and thank them and over for what they had done. That feeling was incredibly overwhelming for me.
That's Shabana Basij-Rasik. She eventually graduated from Middlebury College in Vermont, and she's now the managing director of SOLA. It's a nonprofit that helps young Afghan women get access to education. And when we originally aired Shabana's story back in December, she wrote to tell us that afterwards, she heard from hundreds of public radio listeners like you who reached out to support her. And you know, here at the TED Radio Hour, we love bringing you stories like this one. In order for us to keep doing that, we need your help. So if Shabana's story inspired you, if it moved you in any way, and you want to hear more stories like this one, we hope you'll really consider making a contribution to this station. It's simple, but it's really, really important, and it helps us do what we do. So here's how you can do it.
Help keep the storytelling tradition alive and well in the Tennessee Valley with a pledge of support for the TED Radio Hour or any other program on our schedule that you enjoy. We know that's a big reason people tune in public radio is because of the storytelling aspect. Shows like the TED Radio Hour. The TED Radio Hour got its start on our HD3 News Talk channel, which we previewed last week, and so did Snap Judgment, which has become one of public radio's hottest new shows. Tonight, we're previewing some of the best shows on our main signal, and we hope that you're enjoying the show so far. Stay tuned. Coming up later this hour, we'll hear from the World Cafe with songs from Jason Isbell. This is the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville, our award-winning mix of special programs and homemade radio features. We hope that you'll support us during our spring fund drive as we try to raise $120,000 for all the news, music, and other programs that you enjoy on this station. So please, if you can, support us at WLRH.org. And thanks to everyone who's been supporting us because of our public service announcement program, which serves more than 60 local nonprofits by providing free on-air exposure for their community service missions.
The Madison Chamber of Commerce invites you to taste the spirit of Madison at Insanity Complex on Saturday, April 14th. You can visit the best local shops and businesses at our Madison Market from 9 to 2 and enjoy local food trucks. Great fun for the whole family. Evening food tasting features samples from 20-plus local restaurants and craft breweries. Live music in the evening. Information at 256-325-8317 and madisonalchamber.com.
You can celebrate Earth Month at the North Alabama Agriplex with Dr. Larry Davenport as he presents The Nature of Nature Journaling on Tuesday, April 17th at 6 p.m. The Agriplex Heritage Center is located on Tallyho Street in Cullman. Dr. Davenport will also sign his book after the program. This lecture series is part of Alabama's bicentennial celebration and is open to the public. Information at agriplex.org.
It's that time again. Meet Your Muslim Neighbor will be held on Saturday, April 21st from 2 until 6 p.m. at the Huntsville Islamic Center on Sparkman Drive. All are welcome to share great food and conversation while learning about your Muslim neighbors. This event features tours, traditional food, and clothing. Information at huntsvilleislamiccenter.org.
Rock the Vote returns on Tuesday, April 17th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Stone Event Center at Campus 805. You can register to vote and meet candidates for office from your neighborhood. You can also enjoy complimentary barbecue and beverages and live music by Jedi, brought to you by the Committee of 100 Young Professionals. Rock the Vote on Tuesday, April 17th. Information at huntsvillecommitteeof100.org.
Okay, so my roommate Paul and I, we just moved to a house in Detroit, Michigan. Now, Paul, there's lots to be said about Paul, but for now, I'm just going to mark that he's an accomplished, fairly good-looking white guy. He's intense. He's always thinking these thoughts like, the Constitution only applies to the first 13 states, or 95% of the universe is dark matter, and nobody knows what the rest of it's made of. That's just the way he is. And because Paul's interested in everything, it surprises me not in the least when I arrive home one day to find him watching a TV show featuring Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam.
Look, brothers and sisters.
What Paul finds personally appealing about Farrakhan's message of black empowerment, I do not know. But then it's Paul. And Paul is really digging on this show. He's clapping and cheering. That's right, Lewis, that's right. Then I hear the shouting. I run out. What's the problem? Farrakhan just said that black women shouldn't date white dudes. He said it's an abomination. Calm down. People say stuff on TV. But what if I want to talk to one of these sisters? Brother, it's your lucky day. We live in Detroit. There's plenty to choose from, and Farrakhan doesn't run this. Well, I see him. He's fuming, right? Whatever, I figure in a few days, he'll forget all about it. But he doesn't forget. He keeps talking about how Louis Farrakhan let him down, how it's not right that the Nation of Islam the Detroit chapter founded by one Malcolm X isn't cool with equal opportunity getting down. Paul, it does not matter. It doesn't matter. He will not listen. And one day, we're driving down the street about to pick up some barbecue when we see 8 or 9 Nation of Islam fellas. They're clean shaven, pressed suit, bow tied, no nonsense, serious about their business brothers walking down the street. And Paul pulls over the car and he's like, I'm gonna go talk to him about this thing with black women. And this right here, this here is where I put my foot down. Are you crazy? That's the fruit. You don't go messing with the fruit. What's wrong with you? Huh? What's the fruit? The fruit of Islam are the paramilitary arm of the Nation of Islam. The brothers that don't play. Black nationalists are scared of them. Let it go, Paul. I'm just gonna go talk to him. Don't do it, Paul. Let it go. Paul opens the door, strolls over to the fellas, and it's the end of the line time for man Paul. I lean way down in the car so no one mistakes me as being with this crazy person, and I wait for the unfortunate tragedy to unfold. It shouldn't take long. I ease my head up to window level, only to see Paul hanging with the fruit of Islam. Everybody joking and laughing. He's like, all right, later on, fellas. He gets back in the car, all smiles. What'd they say? I convinced them. You convinced them? Yup. He pulls out into traffic. He pauses. Then he looks at me serious. Yeah, but we should probably lay off the pork. Today, on Stamp Judgment, we proudly present The End of the Line. Amazing stories from real people pushing past their own point of no return. My name is Glenn Washington. Please make sure your emergency information is in order. Because this is Snap Judgment. Now for our first story. You have to go to a little-known place in California where Jesse De La Cruz grew up. He knew he had two choices. He could either be a farmhand like Pops or make his own path. Snap Judgment.
There was a guy in my neighborhood. His name was Big Inyo. And he was basically the guy that really trained me to become who I was. And you know, everybody talked about him like he was God, bro. Like, you know, everybody was like, wow, you know. And I was like, you know, I was mesmerized by what everybody said. And I knew he was in prison. I knew he was in prison. He had been in prison for a long time, right? And he had a wife, her name was Thelma. And you would never hardly see Thelma. It's like she was doing time with Indio, you know what I mean? So I remember looking at her thinking, man, that's the kind of woman I want, just like that. So I met Big Indio when he came out in probably in 1960. Indio was about, I don't know, maybe 6'1". He reminded me, I'm not lying, man, he reminded me of these Aztec warriors that I had seen in the library, right, in the picture books. You know, broad-chested, wide-shouldered, bronze, big mustache, hair jet black, comb to the back, you know, laid down, right? And he had tattoos, you know, like all over his body. Nice tattoos, right? And he was ironing his pants. And I didn't know it at the time, but what he was doing, he was watching me with his peripheral vision. And I was in awe, right? I was like, oh, man. And all of a sudden, he turned and he looked at me and he goes, what's your name, little vato? And I said, who, me? And he goes, yeah, you. And I said, my name is Chuy, because that's what my mom called me, right? Jesus. I said, but everybody calls me that I won. I flex my chest, right? And he sort of like grinned at the gesture, right? And he like looked at me and he goes, hey, look at, he goes, check this out. I'm gonna tell you something. I don't ever want you to forget this. He said, never ever trust the white man and never trust the black man. He said, always stick with your raza and remember that we're in a war. And I went, damn. When people walk down the street, you know what I mean? Even though they might have not liked being Indio, they acknowledged him, letting him know that they knew he was somebody to be reckoned. That's the way I took it. So I watched it all. I said, man, you know, and he had everything. He never worked. But I'll tell you one thing, he always was dressed really nice. He had a nice car. And I think, well, how in the heck he do that, man? Well, I found out later he was a criminal, you know what I mean? So I said, I want to be a criminal. They had nice women, they had nice cars, they partied, they did all the things without even having to work. Then I heard, but they had to go to jail periodically, right? And I said, well, you know, that's part of the job description, man. You know, go to jail. So I made a decision, and Indio began to school me. Like, in other words, he would tell me, listen, don't ever break into people in the barrio's home. Don't steal from them, because they ain't got nothing. Go out and steal from the farmers, the ranchers. They got plenty. You know what I mean? Get it from them, right? He would tell me, don't talk, because when you talk, you can't hear what's going on. Now I talk. Back then I didn't. It's a backdrop of some mountains, right? There's mountains, and then this huge facility made of stone, right? And then you see the gun towers, right? And you see the fence, big double lane, chain link, you know, barbed wire fence, right? And I was like, wow. And so my heart started pounding. I remember my heart started pounding, and I was like, wow, you know, I'm here, man. Okay. You know, prison, it was like a rush. You know, it was like it made you feel, it made me feel like I was important. You know what I mean? You know, like I was somebody. These were my kind of people. They all had that look. It was a look in the eye that told everybody, you need to be real careful here. You know what I mean? Because this is somebody that will take your wind, right? So, you know what I mean? Everybody had that look. I was in San Quentin. I remember one time I was in San Quentin in the hole, and I seen the look in this guy, right? And I thought to myself, damn, that dude's got the look of death in his eyes, right? And I wondered if I had that look, because I was there too, right where he was at. That's what I thought, right? But I couldn't see it, because in the hole, you don't have mirrors. So I had to wait till the following day when I went to take a shower, and they give you a little square stainless steel mirror, right? And I looked, and I said, man, I have that look too, man. It sort of depressed me, right? So years later, you know, when I was, I think I was about 30 years old, which would have made Indio about in his 50s. I came out of prison, I think it was my second time. And I went back to the neighborhood just to visit. And I went to the park where everybody, you know, the fellas hung out, right? And when I got there, Indio was there. But he didn't look like he looked back then. In other words, he was not this Aztec warrior anymore. He was, you know, he was an old man. You know, he was an old man ravaged by the lifestyle, you know, alcohol and drugs, you know what I mean? And Thelma had left him. You know, he's just nobody no more, right? And he was drinking some type of beer. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was a quart he had in the bag, you know. And it was a little bit daunting to go against him, right? Because I always used to look up to him, you know what I mean? So I sort of had to conjure, what's the word? I think that's the word. The courage to address him, you know, to confront him with what I thought was his manipulation of me, right? You know what I'm saying? And so when I've got to that point, I just blurted it out. I told him, "You lied to me, man." He said, "I didn't lie to you." And I said, "Yeah, you did. The people that were trying to kill me was Mexicans just like me. Blacks weren't trying to kill me. White people weren't trying to kill me. It was Mexicans like me that were trying to kill me. It was you that was trying to kill me." I remember he looked up and he looked at me like, "What?" I don't think he was prepared for me to do what I did. He goes, "No." He goes, "That might be true, but I did not lie to you. I schooled you because I knew, I seen where you were going. I knew when I saw you that you were going to end up in this journey. And the things that I taught you kept you alive." He was right. He was right, bro. But at the time, I didn't know it because I was full of anger. So I stabbed him. I didn't kill him. I just stabbed him a couple of times. You know, I just wanted to let him know. I wanted him to feel a little pain.
Big thanks to Jesse for sharing your story. Now he has things turned around. He graduated with a doctorate in education, works as a gang expert, helping those falsely accused fight the charges. The original score for that story was by Snap's own Leon Morimoto and was produced by a dear friend of mine, Daniel Alarcón, from the amazing podcast Radio Ambulante. Subscribe with the quickness. We'll have a link at snapjudgment.org. You're surprised, right? Didn't see that coming, huh? So ask yourself, seriously, ask yourself, where else are you going to hear from that guy? Where else? Nowhere else. So keep the surprises coming. Support the station that plays the stories that matter. This station depends on you. But here's the thing. You depend on it.
This is the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville, and we're previewing some of the best storytelling shows on our main signal tonight in hopes of convincing you to support us during our spring fund drive. We're trying to raise $120,000 by Saturday afternoon, and we need your help to get there. Please give now at WLRH.org. Speak up for your favorite programs, or if you have a program to suggest, we'd love to hear from you. As we've been saying this hour, storytelling is an important part of our programming schedule and an important tradition in the Deep South, many times manifesting itself in the rich musical heritage of this part of the country. North Alabama's Jason Isbell is a rising star on the music scene and is featured frequently on The World Cafe, which airs Monday through Thursday nights at 9 o'clock on this signal. We know that many of you tune in 89.3 Huntsville for the music, lots of classical music, lots of everything else as well. So if it's something important to you, let us know. Make a donation and share a comment right now at WLRH.org.
It's the World Cafe. I'm Talia Schlanger. Thank you for supporting your local public radio station. We love you for throwing your support behind the music that you love. And here is a love song for the ages. Lovey, lovey, lovey. I know. It's Jason Isbell singing with his wife, Amanda Shires, on the song If We Were Vampires.
It's not the long flowing dress that you're in, or the light coming off of your skin, the fragile heart you protected for so long, or the mercy in your sense of right and wrong. It's not your hands searching slow in the dark, or your nails leaving love's watermark. It's not the way you talk me off the roof, your questions like directions to the truth. It's knowing that this can't go on forever, likely one of us will have to spend some days alone. Maybe we'll get 40 years together, but one day I'll be gone, one day you'll be gone. We were vampires and death was a joke. We'd go out on the sidewalk and smoke and laugh at all the lovers and their plans. I wouldn't feel the need to hold your hand. Maybe time running out is a gift. I'll work hard till the end of my shift and give you every second I can find. Hope it isn't me who's left behind. It's knowing that this can't go on forever. Likely one of us will have to spend some days alone. Maybe we'll get 40 years together. One day I'll be gone. One day you'll be we'll have to spend some days alone. Maybe we'll get 40 years together. One day I'll be gone. One day you'll be gone.
Losing hand and make it when I'm leaving Las Vegas. The dancer and Lido Day girls, they had me dealing blackjack until one or two. Such a muddy line between the things you want and the things you have to do. Oh, I'm leaving Las Vegas. Lights so bright, palm sweating a blackjack on a Saturday night. I'm leaving Las Vegas. I'm leaving for good. I'm leaving for good.
Sheryl Crow with a live performance of Leaving Las Vegas. Before that, If We Were Vampires, Jason Isbell. Both recorded live for the World Cafe. That's what we're doing here on the show during this Fun Drive edition. I'm Talia Schlanger, really happy to bring you live performances from the World Cafe. That song you heard Sheryl Crow do, Leaving Las Vegas, that was not the first time or the last time that she visited the World Cafe. Somewhere in the middle of her handful, I think somewhere around 6 or 7 visits to the World Cafe over the years, she came in for her very first record, Tuesday Night Music Club, and spoke to David Dye. He said she was a sort of young hippie chick carrying her guitar up 3 flights of stairs. And of course, then she became mega famous, a big superstar, one of the most important voices in the 90s. She came and visited us recently in 2017, and she's continued to come back to the World Cafe. And as a result, you've gotten to grow up with Sheryl Crow. You get to know an artist like Sheryl Crow over time on a show like this on your local public radio station. It's like checking in with your favorite relative every few years, saying, hey, how you doing? What have you been up to? If you've loved getting to know an artist over the course of time, over the course of their career, thanks to public radio, please help us keep it going strong. Here's somebody to tell you how to do just that.
It's our spring fun drive here at 89.3 Huntsville, and we hope that you will support us. You can go right now to our website at WLRH.org. Check out our progress as we climb toward our $120,000 goal, hopefully by Saturday afternoon. And if you can, make a financial contribution to your favorite programs and help our community service mission continue to thrive here in the Tennessee Valley. This has been the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville, our award-winning mix of special programs and homemade radio features. We hope you tune in to this program over the next 3 weeks as we bring you the new season, Season 4 of Invisibilia, the show about the invisible forces that shape human behavior. Then coming up in May, our volunteer producers with the Community Newsroom get cranked back up for more homemade radio features featuring stories and voices from the Tennessee Valley. City Arts and Lectures is coming up next. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting Huntsville Public Radio. I'm Brett Tannehill. Good night.
Invisibilia is back for a new season with all new stories.
Pull out a .22 rifle and yell, everyone get down, this is a robbery.
We have stories about small personal battles.
I didn't leave my house.
I wanted somebody to see me.
Really sorry about the past.
And stories about huge cultural issues.
This is probably going to get somebody killed.
Just evil.
So tune in for Invisibilia Season 4.
That's next Thursday night at 7 o'clock on the Public Radio Hour.
I'm T. Mill, host of the podcast In Tune with T. Mill. I listen to public radio and I'm a fan of public radio because they give details and they are a resource to the community of what's going on and how to get involved in the things that matter. If community matters to you, then you should invest in your community and start with public radio. I'm Tim Miller, a volunteer with the Community Newsroom here at WLRH. I hope you will support WLRH by making a donation and tuning in.